All right, so today we sort of bring together or build on, in a way, on some of the discussions we had previously. We were talking about different aspects of fertility. And one of the issues that comes up in context of fertility is that when a woman chooses to fertilize or even just to freeze a certain number of embryos, essentially you then run the potential challenge on the other side of the discarding of embryos, of pre-embryos, etc. And we mentioned last time that back in the 2000s, this was a big subject of dispute. I think we mentioned this during the Bush era around the issue of embryonic stem cell research. And the question is, if you're going to do studies in the lab on these embryonic stem cells, which at least at the time, they thought that these pluripotent stem cells would yield all sorts of really fascinating insights, and then you would discard them, is that permissible? And at that time, you obviously had a very strong level of influence of the church, right, in the Bush administration, and so, or that was a factor, and so the Christian conservatives, lowercase c, who were opposed to these things, became very active and advocated against this. But the truth is that the question of the discarding of a pre-embryo is really an extension of, or a part of, the larger discussion of the status of any fetus or embryo prior to having been born. I don't mean to say they're the same question, but I mean to say they are part of the same larger set of issues, which ultimately goes to the question of how does halacha define life?
During the Bush administration, I think NIH funding was denied.
Was discontinued, yeah.
People who were denied studying stem cell research. Mm-hmm. We set back the course of science several years.
Right. Although, again, some say that they have not, just on a medical, and I'm not qualified to weigh in on this, but on the medical side of things, that they have not yielded the kind of information and insight that we thought they might.
How could they, if you don't have enough research?
Right? Well, it came back during the Obama era.
Oh,
it was done in other countries.
Yeah.
I think the potential is there. It may just not be realized.
I have no way. I completely defer to the experts in the room on this issue. I'm going to keep my rabbinic hat on, and I'm going to not pretend to do the whole professor, doctor, medical doctor thing. So, I mean,
embryonic stem cells are being differentiated into cell lines, and right now there are some ongoing studies of regenerative therapies using these cell lines.
Mm-hmm. For cardiac tissue,
but when it's an embryonic stem cell, it's not yet a heart. You have to differentiate it into cardiac tissue.
Well,
that's
what
the potential is. Yeah. So, right. I think it'll take these studies, you know, they take years and years to do, so it'll take a few years until it's done whether...
I mean, stem cells do differentiate into all these other cells.
Exactly.
The question is why and how do you control it? But the potential is huge when you do.
Yeah.
So at that time, there were questions that were raised from among halachic poskim, halachic authorities. What about the discarding of embryos in halacha? And there's some discussion about that. Suffice it to say that the halachic authorities generally are more lenient than the hardcore conservative Christian ones on this issue. But at the same time, they still take it, hi, how are you? Come on in. They still take the issue seriously and are concerned about just simply discarding something that has the potential for life, just to throw it away sort of, you know, without regard to its sanctity and its potential and so on and so forth. So just as the question that we've been discussing in previous weeks of embryonic stem cell research and the discarding of embryos, which we discussed in past weeks, is a relevant and live ethical question, halachic question, it then takes us to the question of abortion, which is what I really want to focus on today, because the question of discarding something that has the potential for life is, of course, a piece of this larger discussion. And this really becomes a major issue. We know it's been a hot-button issue in American politics for God knows how long now. And the question is, where does halacha fall out? And what's very interesting is that, you know, I like to say with my students that if you give multiple choice quiz question or something like that, and so one answer is yes, you know, what does the Gemara say about X? And then the answer is either yes or no, or it's a subject of machloket or debate. Right? So of course, inevitably, the answer is going to be it's a machloket. So why should abortion be any different? The rabbis, as we'll see, have a whole sort of host of different opinions around these issues. And yet at the same time, I think it's also fair to say that we fall somewhere in between. On the one hand, the typical Christian view that you hear voiced, in other words, we don't go that far. But at the same time, sort of a secular perspective that certainly an abortion on demand, certainly abortion on demand prior to the age of viability, which is the law in many, many states in the United States, right? We're just pushing up the age of viability, right? So that's been, you know, last time I checked, it was like a couple of years ago, it was like 26 weeks. But now they've had cases where I think they've had 23, 24 weeks.
I think even less.
Even less, 22, whatever it is. And so it's very interesting how that has been shifting too. But in principle, right, in many, this typical state law is abortion on demand until the point of independent viability, or the possibility of viability. So I think halakha, on the one hand, rejects, I think, both of those extremes, and yet, as we'll see, has a whole host of diverse opinions that are associated with it, and it's really fascinating. So what I'm going to do is basically, we're probably going to have to do this in two times. What I'm going to do today is to kind of map out what are the basic sources from which halakhic authorities develop a halakhic view with regard to the nature of abortion. Okay, what is the status of abortion according to halakha? We're going to see a tremendous paradox that lies at the heart of this topic in terms of how we treat Jews and Gentiles. I think it's very, very interesting switcheroo, as you'll see fairly quickly. And then we're going to kind of outline the range of views. And then next time, what we'll be in position to do, God willing, is to say, okay, given this whole host of different opinions, that's going to have practical ramifications on all the really, really hard cases of abortion. Cases of where we know that it's a T-sex baby, God forbid, cases or other genetic disorders. What about in a case of rape, God forbid? What about, you know, a minor? What about incest, adultery, etc.? All these different scenarios, which are hotly disputed, number one. And number two, we're going to ask the question, are there different phases? Like, in other words, from Catholic perspective, from a Christian perspective, right, it's all the same. Right? An embryo is an embryo is an embryo. A fetus is a fetus is a fetus. In halakha, that's not the case. We're going to see there are different cutoff points. We're going to see 40 days. We're going to see 3 months. Maybe there are different halakhic statuses to, in terms of how we view abortion at these different times. So that's sort of a sketch for this time, and God willing, for next. And we start with a really interesting source. Take a look at number one. So here you have a pasuk in Parshat Mishpatim. And Pasuk in Parshat Mishpatim is discussing questions of torts, right? So I always like to say that first year law school, right? So you got it, right? Straight, it's Parshat Mishpatim, the hot deal, right? But it's all there. So with some differences, of course. So here's one interesting ruling. V'chi yinatsu anashim, when these men get into a fight. V'nagafu isha harav yatsu yiladeha. And so God forbid, one of them pushes accidentally, in other words. There's an unintentional pregnant woman who gets caught in the middle of this argument, of this fight. In other words, right? It, God forbid, causes a miscarriage. Velo yihye ason, which is an unusual phrase. Let's assume no other damage occurs, they say. It's in the translation, anoshi anesh, kashir yashilav bala ishavinatam biflilim. Essentially, a person is going to be fined. Right? In other words, there's a monetary payment. So here's an accidental act of causing a fetus to die, essentially, to be miscarried. And what's the punishment?
Monetary.
Why is that interesting? Right, what are the other alternatives one could have imagined? Put someone to... Oh, wait. Well, for what's the punishment for murder in halakha? Right? It's going to be... Well, they're close. I mean, the differences are relatively minor. It's actually decapitation, but you get the idea, right? That's for our purposes, right? That's the point.
It's not intentional.
Ah, so if it's intentional, so then you're going to be put to death for murder in halakha. What if it's unintentional, though? What happens if I unintentionally kill someone? I run the risk of being sent where? To Yirmiklah, to exile. Right? That's right. That's explicit in the Torah. No one ever said in halacha, no one ever suggested that if I accidentally cause a miscarriage in exactly the same way that I killed someone such that I would be sent to exile, that I'm similarly sent to exile for killing the fetus. Instead, I'm paying money. Right? Which is not to say that it's permissible to abort or to kill the fetus, but what does that imply?
Different kind of crime.
Right, it's a different kind of crime. It's less important. It doesn't rise to the level of murder.
Right, it's not live. It's not
right.
Live.
And maybe go so far as to say it's not really a living being.
Exactly.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, yeah. And then there'll be all sorts of ramifications for this, potentially.
But I see where you're going with this, but so the first thing to me, of course, that I didn't like was.
Does everyone know Rachel? Sorry. Does everyone know everyone? Let's do a sorry. I should have had an
intro.
Sorry about that.
I just moved here about a year ago. My son's a sophomore.
Very nice to meet you.
So, sorry I waited so long to do the little quick intro. I apologize for that. I was like, you know, actually, it's only been a year. Yeah, go ahead.
So that the husband gets to decide when it happened to the wife. But okay, this was at that time. But that you could put a monetary figure on something that's so emotional for a woman.
Right.
That this is not an abortion. This is not something that the woman would have wanted.
Right.
Or needed.
Good.
So it seems to me that it should carry more weight. Because to the woman, it's a baby. It's a child.
100%, yeah.
So this to me seems a little bit like, you know, give us some money and, you know, we'll call it a day. And also sort of the whole thing of a woman being property, being reduced to a financial.
100%, right. Right, so let me take, well, those are both great points. On the former point, one of the things about Mishpatim is that it's only dealing with the financial implication. So it doesn't mean to say that there aren't broader ramifications, and indeed in such a case, a Beit Din would have the right and responsibility to levy whatever, you know, appropriate measures would be responsible in this case. And there are halachic categories of causing someone either shame or causing them emotional damage, that halacha very much recognizes those categories. An entire chapter in Masechet Bava Kamma, which actually talks about exactly these issues, that's in terms of that. In terms of the other piece, so I think it might also be situational. I think the reality at that time was also that, frankly, that the men tended to be out in the public sphere and tended to be in these fights more regularly. I have to confess, seeing things haven't changed. I mean, at least if some people in the building are any indication, and not those assembled at present. At least on the physical side of things. So I don't think it means to say that the woman here is just sort of a prop or anything like that, but I do think it means to say that this is a particular scenario in which we typically have the men who are engaged in an altercation, and this would be a ramification, but I don't think it means to, with the sense of sidelining, I don't think it's intended in that way. But still, it would seem to indicate that, yeah, this is not considered a full-fledged halachic life, something along those lines. If you take a look at Rashi and Source 2, we won't read it, but Rashi essentially reads it in this way, based on the Gemara. In other words, this is really exactly the upshot of this statement. And there's a problem with this, or a basic question that we have to ask. Because if you take a look at source number 3, you have a very interesting passage in Gemara. If you look at Tractate Sanhedrin, there are about 4 pages there, 4 daf in the Gemara, that deal almost exclusively with a fascinating area of halacha, which is, according to Jewish law, what are the obligations incumbent upon Noahides? The 7 Noahide laws, sorry, all of that. These 4 daf of Masechet Sanhedrin deal almost exclusively with that topic. It's absolutely fascinating. It's very interesting because almost all of halacha is about what are the obligations incumbent upon Jews. And then all of a sudden, you have 4 daf in the Gemara is what are our views with regard to the responsibilities of others, of Gentiles as well. It's very interesting. And you would expect that since we've got 6 through 13 and they have 7, that probably our laws are more stringent than theirs. But check this. One of the 7 Noahide laws is murder. And we know that for all, by the way, for the violation of all 7 Noahide laws, you're put to death. Okay? Ben Noach is put to death for violation of any of those 7. One of them is murder. So where it says like this, Mishum Rabbi Ishmael Amru, in the name of Rabbi Ishmael, they said the following. Af al ha'ubarin. Right? Ubar is Hebrew for a fetus. Af al ha'ubarin. In other words, you're even put to death for killing fetuses, meaning Gentiles are. My time with Rabbi Ishmael, what is the reason for Rabbi Ishmael? The Chassid, as it says in the Pasuk in Breshit, this is in Parshat Noach, immediately after Noach and his family emerge unscathed from the Teva. So God issues a whole set of new rules, and he says, Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech. That one who spills the blood of a person in a person, his blood shall be spilled. The Gemara says, what does it mean, a person in a person? Yeah, quite literally. The Gemara says, "Haviyomer." I would say is that Uber should be meimo. This is a fetus in its mother's womb. Now, shofech dam haadam, baadam damo yishafech. In other words, his blood shall be spilled. What's the punishment for someone who kills a fetus, according to this Gemara?
But this is bemazed.
This is bemazed. That's correct.
We haven't established what the punishment for a Jew is.
Good. Yes, that's source 4. Okay. Excellent. Means it is intentional. 100%. Good. But if it's intentional, the Gentile is put to death. Gentile is put to death. So Paya, right? Paya says, okay, but the case in Mishpatim was unintentional. Now, we've already shown that it's distinct from a typical act of accidental killing.
Yeah.
But what about intentional killing? So now you have Gemara in source 4 that puts it all together.
Why don't we assume that this pasuk also applies to Jews? Why do we assume it's just that Noah?
So this Gemara is going to answer that too. I think you're essentially asking the same thing as your wife.
Okay.
Right?
No, we're always on the same page.
Always on the same page. There were so many jokes, Paya. There were just so many jokes. I didn't want to say better half. I tried to reserve that for myself. You know, me and my wife, better half, fine. You know, anyone else, you guys. It's not for me to say. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin is talking about the fact that the Torah seems to repeat a charge or a law that someone who, a Jew, talking about more typical halachot, nerds with Jew and Jew, those halachot, how they're treated. So the Gemara says, why is it seemingly written twice that a person who hits someone else is punished? So it says, v'itzrich lemichtav makeish, that it was necessary to write, for the Torah to write one who strikes a man, v'itzrich lemichtav kol make nefesh, and it was also necessary for the Torah to write anyone who smites a life. Why? That if the Torah had written that someone who kills someone else and that person, the victim, dies, hava amina, so the Gemara says, I might have thought that ish de bar mitzvah in katan lo. Right? So I would say, it's the fourth line in English, that one who strikes a man, i.e. an adult, is obligated in the mitzvah, who's obligated in the mitzvah. So that person, or as if I kill an adult, then, in other words, someone who's over bar bat mitzvah, then I'm put to death. But if it's a katan, if it's someone who's under bar bat mitzvah, I might have thought that I'm not liable for capital punishment, which is a pretty shocking kind of suggestion. Thankfully, one that we reject. But the hava mina, in other words, the initial thought of the Gemara is that maybe if I kill an infant, then I'm not put, it's a terrible thing, it's tragic, it's horrible, but I'm not put to death. The ikat of rachmana, on the other hand, the Torah says, if the Torah had written kol maki nefesh, anyone who smites a soul, hava amina, I might have thought, afilu nefalim, afilu ben shmona. I would have thought that I'm even put to death for killing a fetus, at least one that's not viable. Right? No, I'm not put to death for killing. I would have thought that I am put to death, sorry, for killing a fetus. What's the halacha? Okay? You're not. So, now, so what's this Gemara saying? The Gemara is saying that you are, if a Jew, someone a Jew, who kills a child, that's full-fledged murder. Okay? That could run the risk of capital punishment. But if you kill at least a non-viable fetus, then what's the halacha? Are you put to death for that? Right? You're not put to death for that. That's what the Gemara is saying here.
8 months is a viable.
Ah, so now that's a separate discussion.
In the time of the Gemara.
Did you see they added here? Who? This is, by the way, this is from Sepharia. So Sepharia had licensed from the Koran translation of the Talmud. They're putting out these volumes. So that's an English translation of Rabbi Steinsaltz's translation of the Gemara. So Rabbi Steinsaltz, whenever he would elaborate the Gemara in Hebrew, they translated that in English and they put it in non-bold. So the bold is a literal interpretation of the Gemara, and the non-bold is Rabbi Steinsaltz's sort of, you know, it's like if you ever use an art school Gemara, they kind of just like elaborate a lot, so he did very much the same. So the Gemara assumes that a child who is in the 8th month of pregnancy and is delivered is not viable. This is a whole discussion, doesn't seem to square with our medical information now, but of course.
But I don't see that coming out of, and maybe it's not something we should spend time on now, but I don't see that coming out of the words of the Gemara.
That what?
Half a minute.
What do you mean?
That I don't see why you come to this conclusion as to why both languages were necessary.
So you're right, I don't want to get too stuck up on it, but the point of the Gemara is to say there's one case where you would have thought that you're not put to death, and there's another case where you would have thought that you are put to death, and the reason that you have both psukim there is in order to establish precisely that distinction. All right, so that's why they're two chidushim, they're two novel ideas. You need two psukim to teach you, right? You would have thought one way, teach another one, thought another way, and it teaches you the second point as well. The bottom line is that what seems to emerge from this Gemara is that if a Jew kills a fetus, what's the halakha?
Not put to death.
Okay, so now we can add 2 and 2 and get 4. If a Jew, and this is universally accepted, or any halachic authority who doesn't take this as a starting point for granted, that paradoxically or ironically, if a Gentile kills a fetus, if a Gentile aborts, potentially it's capital punishment, and that's the Gemara that we saw over here in Source 3. But if a Jew does the same thing, a Jew is not put to death for that.
So you're saying, making the distinctions between an abortion and being someone killing that person, like in a fight or something.
So, no. I'm saying that even in a full-fledged case of abortion, intentional, the whole nine yards, no reason, no justification whatsoever, all things being equal, that for a Gentile, it seems to be the equivalent of killing a living, breathing human being, and for a Jew, it's not. And for a Jew, you're not put to death. There's no capital punishment. But which is extremely interesting. I say, look, if you're going to obligate us in 613 mitzvot and B'nai Noach in only 7, then, you know, like, you should let us off the hook somewhere. But still, it's very interesting. Yes, bye.
But it's not so clear from the Gemara, the case of someone killing a fetus.
That is viable. That is correct. Now, the question is what viability means. Does that mean post 20 whatever weeks, that might be different. Some say that maybe that is treated differently.
But the point is here, because they say it's deliberately bein shmona, it implies, if I understood correctly, that we're considered a 7-month fetus to be viable.
That's correct.
9 months. So if you killed a 7-month fetus, the halacha is not clear from this.
Put it this way, if you kill a 2-month fetus, the halacha is equally clear. Because a 2-month fetus is equally non-viable as the Gemara treated an 8-month fetus. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. So in which case, that would seem to indicate that at least a non-viable fetus, essentially, the Gemara is saying, is there's no capital punishment. Whereas it's very clear in the Gemara and Sanhedrin we saw earlier, the Gentile who kills in a case of a rehu aborts, there's no distinction that's made whatsoever, and it's quite clear that it would apply equally to a 2-month or to a 7th month or an 8-month or a 9th month. It wouldn't seem to matter. So that basic distinction, let's say if I abort a 2-month-old fetus that the Gentile is considered to be engaging in a full-fledged act of murder and a Jew is not, that does emerge with clarity from the text when you put them together. And that is paradoxical, and it's even stranger because of source number 5, which says that, you know what? There is nothing that is permitted to a Jew and forbidden to a Gentile, right? Which kind of makes sense, because we were Noahides before we were Jews, right? I mean, Adam HaRishon wasn't, he was, I'm sure he was a wonderful person, but he wasn't exactly a Afro Meyid, right? I mean, I'm confident he didn't wear a kippah, okay? I'm going to say something heretical and say, I'm not even sure that Moshe Rabbeinu wore a kippah. Don't quote me on that, I might get in major trouble for this. And anyhow, the things that come out. Right? But more to the point, Jews were obligated. We were Noahides. Now, there is an interesting discussion, just as an aside. How do you understand Har Sinai? This is just a theoretical question. That's an aside. How do you understand what happened there? Did Har Sinai essentially say, not only are Jews obligated in the seven Noahide laws, because we are human beings first,
right,
but then in addition, we also have the covenant of Sinai? Or, right, which... my teacher, Ron Lichtenstein, was very much a fan of. And he actually remembers that when he was, you know, most people who were teenagers, maybe some people in the room are accepted, but most of the things I learned in high school, I have to confess that I don't remember all of them anymore. I hope you'll forgive me for that. Perhaps others feel differently about their own experience. But what? Yeah,
we're a lot older. We
forgot. Okay, there you go. What? All right.
Have you shared that with your students?
What? Only my adult students. Only you. No, of course not. No. More savvy than that. I tell them that I remember everything, of course. I said, this is the most important thing you'll ever learn in your life. Every once in a while, I do pull the, if there's one thing that you remember from what we learned today, it should be this. And that those actually tend to work. So, it was actually yesterday, I had a very intense conversation with students. We have these halacha mini courses, and we're doing Shmirat Halashon, guarding one's tongue and Lashon Hara and so on and so forth. So I said, if you ever hear anyone talk about when teenagers make fun of other people and call them certain kinds of names, like calling someone gay in order to make fun of them and so on and so forth. And I said, all right, guys, everything else we learned today is immaterial. I'm going to tell you something. If you ever talk this way, and these are great kids, but if you ever talk this way, if you ever hear anyone talk this way, and you know it's not just the word gay, I said, let me tell you what you're doing. Let me tell you the suffering that you're causing and so on and so forth. And I said, all the other stuff is important, but listen to this and hear it well. So every once in a while I stop and say,
okay,
if there's one thing you remember, it should be this. But yeah, no, so most of the things from my own high school experience, I really don't remember. But Rav Lichtenstein was, I guess, a little bit smarter, so he did remember. When he was in high school at Chaim Berlin in New York, he remembers that the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Huttner, once gave a shir in which he argued, based on the Rambam, that the Rambam holds that Jews are Noahides plus. Exactly this question. That it's not that we have the seven Noahide laws and now those are set aside and we have only the laws of the covenant at Sinai, but rather it's, you know, it's sort of one on top of the other. And there's a really interesting side conversation and a lot of this discussion of, well, can the laws of the Noahides be more strict, of B'nai Shev Mitzos B'nai Noach be more strict than the 613 mitzvos, the Tariag mitzvos for Jews, actually very much goes to that question. So it's a whole shir in its own right, a very interesting issue. But either way, the facts on the ground seem to be this. And by the way, there really is no technical contradiction between Source 5 and everything else that we've seen. Why not? What does the Gemara say in Source 5? What exactly?
It's about being permitted. It doesn't mean it's permitted.
Ah, is a Jew permitted to perform abortion, right, to abort? We haven't seen anything explicitly, but we can work under the assumption, especially now based on this Gemara as well, is a Jew permitted to go ahead and to perform an abortion, like it's completely permissible? Right? No. What's the only thing that we said? Rita, go ahead. What did we
say? The type of crime.
The type of crime, and therefore what?
The
the type of punishment, right? The consequences, exactly right, 100%. The Gemara never says that there can't be a discrepancy between, and the truth is that there definitely are other discrepancies, because as I mentioned, all seven of the mitzvot b'nei Noah are punishable by death for Gentiles. It's not true for Jews. For example, one of the seven, perhaps the most enigmatic, is eating a limb from a live animal, Iver min hachai. It's like really an unusual list, because the Gemara says murder and idolatry and illicit relations and setting up basic sense of justice. These were at our CLE program last week, spoke about that. And so on and so forth. You have these very, very fundamental, not cursing God, the very, very fundamental kinds of, and theft. Those are the first six. And then, which are all kind of like basic ethical commandments that we would have expected, and then not eating a limb from a live animal. It's like just kind of a curveball. Like if I had to design my theoretical list, that probably wouldn't have made it at my top, you know, anything, 500, never mind top 7. Now, if a Gentile, therefore, if a Ben Noach eats a limb from a living animal, what's the punishment? Same as all the others, death. If a Jew does so, it's a regular Isser in the Torah. At worst case punishment is lashes. So it's not like this is the only example of that. There are other instances as well.
So
yeah.
It just sounds to me, in just terms of the Noahide laws are general, and the commandments tell you how to deal with the specifics.
Just
flesh it out.
Yeah, one way, 100%, one way of saying it is that sort of the Noahide laws are not subject to a tradition of interpretation of Torah Shebaal Peh through the generations, and are sort of black and white. They sort of need to be sort of, you know, catch-alls, and that's it. And they don't allow for that subtlety. We've got thousands of years of tradition of arguing about the gray areas, as we said, about machloket. So that might account for some of these distinctions.
I mean, I don't know anything about this. This is just... Christians take them literally without any type of interpretation. Is that what's happening here with this discussion with
I don't want to claim expertise in it, and I don't know if all Christians, I don't want to universalize and say, you know, or simplify and say all people of one faith hold the same thing. But my understanding is that it's based in part on this verse, but it's also based on the influence of natural law in the Christian tradition. That's the other piece to this. So, for example, in the Middle Ages, there were many great Christian theologians who believed that we can use natural logic to deduce ethical principles. Remember, they are not as legislatively oriented a system as we are. I mean, we've got all the mitzvot and the whole, one of the major foundations of Christianity was to focus more on the spirit of the law than on the letter of the law, and there's a bit chadasha, and so many of them, there's a new covenant, and the obligations, the mitzvot are abrogated and all of that. And so, for example, in the Middle Ages, you have St. Thomas Aquinas, and Aquinas argues that if you want to know sort of law for Christians, you have to use natural law. In other words, you have to look at the nature of things and to try to extrapolate truths. So very often you'll hear and read Christian theologians saying, well, what difference is there logically between, it's all potential for life. So it's all, right, it's all or nothing. And is there really a difference between, let's say it's fully, right, if it's 40 weeks, right, or it's full term, it's a full term baby, right, 37, 38 weeks, okay, it's full term, and it's a completely viable, what's the only difference between this and a baby that's born, essentially, right, whether or not the baby has actually exited the mother? Is that a logical place? Is that, I mean, what there's no inherent difference in terms of the status of life, right? And so then the argument is, well, and where's that dramatic shift that took place? Like, is there that one moment where we can say, oh, now it's a living being? Maybe the age of viability, you can make that argument. But from a natural law perspective, you might say there's no, like, single moment that we can point to. So if you're going to say, if there's no difference between a full-term baby and when it's born, from a purely rational perspective, one might argue, you could disagree with that, but you could argue that, right? And there's no clear moment at which you draw the lines, then maybe natural law would dictate that a human life is a human life and it should make no difference, and then the implications will flow from there. So that's also very often the kind of argument you'll hear from Christians, because they don't have the same legal tradition that we have. So that's where you have it. So it is true what we've established. I mean, this is really jarring and really, really telling. And as you'll see, this is going to lead us to a host of different views. Okay, so if a Jew performs an abortion, so at least if it's a non-viable fetus, at the very least, you're not put to death. Got it. But you're probably not allowed to do so, let's assume. Why not?
Because it could be life.
Could be life. Okay, good. So what halachic status would we assign it, though? What's the category of the prohibition? Is it an iser from the Torah, or is it an iser from the rabbis, for example? Is it biblical, or is it rabbinic? Anything you could say will be right, according to someone. So, they're all right. Okay. Okay, fine.
I mean, at 8 weeks, you hear the heartbeat. I mean, is it viable outside of the mother's body? No, but it has heart. Okay.
All right.
So,
all right. That's kind of this natural law type of argument, although the pre-embryo, not quite. Yeah. So it's really hard. It's hard to know. And because of this ambiguity, you have a whole host, this gamut. Remember I said we don't have either extreme, right? But we have everything in between those two extremes within the Jewish tradition. And I'll give you some examples. One extreme position, and the reason this is so relevant is not only because it's important to understand the laws of abortion, but the question whether this is a biblical prohibition or a rabbinic prohibition, the question whether this is a form of murder for Jews or not a form of murder for Jews, will have dramatic practical ramifications for almost every instance where we actually want to know the halakhot of abortion. I mean, just because something is generally prohibited, if it's only rabbinically prohibited, there can be lots more exceptions than if it's biblically prohibited. And if it's biblically prohibited because of a typical iser, that's one thing. But if it's a form of murder for a Jew, just that there's no capital punishment, well, that's much more severe. Then maybe I have much less flexibility. So when we come to next time, we talk about the viral questions, almost everything flows from this foundation of, okay, so it's not punishable by death, but what is it? How does halacha view it? And again, it could pretty much every position out there. So let me give you a sense of the range of positions that have been expressed. Some of them are on the sheet, some of them are not on the sheet. Let me just kind of sketch it for you. We could even kind of do it on the board. Maybe I will. Maybe we do when we're done. But basically, it goes as follows. One extreme opinion is that of, let's say, Tosos. Let's start there. The Tosafists, the great Ashkenazic authorities, comment on a Gemara in Tractate Nidah, where the Gemara seems to indicate that if a child has not yet left the mother's womb, if a child is not yet born, it is not yet defined, halachically speaking, as a nefesh. It's not a soul. Tosos commenting on that Gemara seems to say that therefore abortion for a Jew is only subject to a rabbinic prohibition. It's only as we call an Iser Midrabanan. That's how Tosos seems to interpret that Gemara. Now I say seem to interpret that Gemara because them's fighting words. Okay? I mean, not everyone is comfortable saying that for traditional Judaism, abortion is a rabbinic prohibition. So some say, well, that's not really what Tosos is saying. And others say, well, you have the wrong text in Tosa, right? That's always a move. Although there are ambiguous, there really are ambiguous texts in this particular Tosa. Others say, that's what this Tosa says, but I can point you to two or three other passages elsewhere in Tosa where they seem to assume that, of course not, that it's a biblical prohibition. How can you say such a thing? But that is a view that is out there. And as we've mentioned in the past, that is the view of the Tzitz Eliezer. Eliezer Waldenberg, who's a famous Mikkel, we'll talk about this practically, what this looks like next time, but he actually seems to have endorsed the position of Tosfot, leading him to practical relative leniency in terms of allowing for more abortions in certain very, very, very difficult circumstances. So that's one extreme. The opposite end of the spectrum is the position that essentially this is a biblical prohibition, but not only is it a biblical prohibition, but it's an iser from the Torah that is a form of murder. It's basically murder for a Jew, just like it's a murder for a Gentile, except that for whatever reason, the Torah decided to drop the capital punishment. Whatever, how we explain that, or no, we have to explain that anyway. I mean, we already said it's paradoxical. We can come up with theories, but in the end, the facts in the Gemara are the facts in the Gemara. So however you account for that. So who says this? So we'll see perhaps next time that this might be the view of the Rambam. Many have said that this is actually the opinion of the Rambam against Tosa. The Rambam is the other end of the spectrum. But the one who says it explicitly was a much later authority, lived in the 1800s, by the name of Rav Meir Simcha of this town of Divinsk. Okay, not to be confused with Pinsk or Minsk or any of its cousins. Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk is actually one of my favorite rabbis in our tradition. It's hard to rank. How do you rank? goodness. If I had a top 10, would he be in my top 10? I know it's tough, tough to say. He'd be definitely top 20. How's that, okay? He'd be in my top 20 for sure. Why? A couple of reasons. First of all, people know Abba Krieger from here in the community. Yeah. Have you met Abba yet? Okay, so I usually daven at the Hashkama Minyan at the Armenian Synagogue very often, and Abba sits a row in front of me and is known for engaging others in conversation regularly. Hopefully not during davening, but certainly if you come before Hashkama gets started, you have it's prime time for schmoozing time. So I get, since we came, I always had the opportunity to schmooze with Abba regularly. And I learned, as he gets aliyot from time to time, that I believe his name is Abba Meir Simcha. I think I want to say that's his name. Now that's, why is that interesting? Because he told me, I am named, not me, him, speaking for himself, I am named after this same rabbi that we're talking about, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. I said, wow, that's a lot of years. Usually named after someone who lived more recently. He lived, 150 years ago. What's the story? So apparently the story, and I might be getting details slightly wrong, but it's something along the following lines. Abba's grandfather, I want to say, was the chief rabbi of Boston. Chief rabbi of Boston. And he was the chief rabbi of Boston, apparently, immediately before being followed by someone by the name of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Also known as the Rav. Rav Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University fame, commuted to YU, but lived in Boston, was the chief rabbi of Boston, and apparently was preceded by Abba's grandfather, so says Abba. And so he basically takes credit for giving the Rav his first job, or one of his first jobs in getting him to stay in America. That's basically due to Abba's family, and the rest of modern Orthodox history was written on that basis. Turns out that Abba's grandfather was a great-great-grand Talmud student, right, going back to Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. And I think Abba's grandfather had something like 5 names. I might be getting this wrong. And 3 of the names were also, I think, Abba Meir Simcha, something to that effect. In any case, Abba Krieger ultimately is named after Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. So that's one reason that I like Rav Meir Simcha, I like Abba, so I like Rav Meir Simcha as well. And I think I would have liked both either one without the other, but it only helps. The other thing about Rav Meir Simcha that makes him fascinating is that when he was living in this little shtetl town of Dvinsk, he was living alongside one of the other famous rabbis of that generation, also known as the Ragitshever. Rav Yosef Rosen, the Ragitshever Gaon, was a great Hasidic thinker who was known for being almost a quasi-ascetic. In other words, he basically locked himself in a room all day, barely slept. Okay, so you're in good company, at least for today, in general. No problem, sorry about that. He would sit and learn all day long. His hair was famously in tussles. It was like he wasn't exactly the most well-groomed. He didn't think that a haircut was worth his time, or that was, maybe he was a Nazir, I'm not sure exactly the story. And he would sit and learn, all day long, and he wrote Svarim that are renowned in the world of the Yeshivos. Now, these were two of the great scholars of their generation living in the same community at the same time. And not only that, but this was at a time when the Hasidim, followers of the Baal Shem Tov, etc., and the Misnagdim, which are the original Lithuanian style rabbis who were so called Misnagdim because they were Mitnagim, they were opposed to the Hasidic movement, still very often had lots of antagonism and often disagreed vociferously around all sorts of issues, and sometimes there were challenges to Jewish unity because of their arguments or disagreements. But Rav Meir Simcha and the Ragitshever got along beautifully. A really beautiful model of rabbinic unity in a community, even though they, and yes, that's a keeper, unity in the community, and they actually had a tremendous mutual respect for one another and an excellent working relationship, despite their very basic disagreements about a lot of very basic issues. Anyhow, why do I mention all of this? Because it's an excuse to talk about Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, and also as a way of introducing his view on the subject of abortion, because his opinion on abortion is the opposite view of that of the Tosfos that I quoted. He basically says it's full-fledged murder for a Jew. It's just that there's a special pasuk that tells us that a Jew is not punished for this. So that's the opposite end of the spectrum. And then you've got positions in between. My positions in between are not fully represented on this sheet, but I'll give you one that's not represented and one that is. So one view is an in-between view, which says that it's an iser from the Torah, but doesn't rise to the level of murder, forgery. What else could it be? What would be the basis of the prohibition? It's not murder. So what is it? So there's a rabbi by the name of the Mabit, or Moshe of Trani, lived in Italy in the 16th century. He says that actually this is a form of what we call chavala. What's chovel in halacha? It means to cause a wound to someone else. It says, now there are two variants on this. The more common variant is say, it's essentially causing a wound to the mother. You're right. The fetus is not an independent entity until birth. But why is this any different than if a person, you know, goes and, you know, damages someone else's limb and, you know, throws a punch and causes them damage, you know? Sends them hurtling down the, yeah, skiing down the mountain and break a leg, right? That's where the saying comes from. Why is this different than that? So the Mabit's suggestion is it's an Iser Doraisa, it's an Iser from the Torah, but it doesn't rise to the level of murder, rather it's a form of chavala. It's a form of wounding, which is not murder, but it is an Iser from the Torah, and it's a more traditional Iser from the Torah. Now, there are two variations even of that theme. The more classical way of saying is that you're damaging limb to the mother, but there's another variation, which is to say that you're actually damaging the fetus itself. What do you think about that? Damaging the fetus.
Absolutely.
You like it. Okay. So we have one endorsement for the Mabit. There you go. Maybe that's your... I told you, it's all...
they're all out there. I can say absolutely this, and then somewhere down the line I might agree with the other side, because, you know, it's so complicated.
Right?
So it's whether the fetus is an independent entity.
That's the difference between the two. Now, here's the only thing. If you think that the fetus is an independent entity, you might say, why are you calling this chavala? Why are you calling this wounding? Once you think it's independent, then just call it murder, right?
Because it's not viable.
Because it's not viable. Well, if it's not viable, is there an Isra chavala for something that, right? In other words, that's not viable? Like, it's a human being, but it's not viable. So you have to say, it's not impossible. By what you're saying, it's not impossible, but you have to...
It's forced, right?
It's a little bit funny. It's like, well, it's not enough of a life because it's not viable, so therefore it doesn't rise... It's not murder. You can't kill it, but you can injure it. Because it is sort... You know, like, it's somewhere in between. It's possible, but it's...
It has the potential for life, and you truncated
that. That is very good. Yeah. And that is source number 9. It's another possibility, right? That's not chavala. Check this source out. This is the Chavot Ya'ir. The Chavot Ya'ir is not on my top 20 list, although maybe it should be. It's really not nice that I'm choosing. I'm really sorry. They're all extraordinary. The Chavot Ya'ir, though, I don't have a story about him, but you have to indulge me. I'm really sorry. This is worth it, I promise. I have a story about myself, which is not what makes it interesting that it's about me. But here, I'll tell you what's interesting. In 2004, have I mentioned this at any point? Tell me if I have cut you off. Tell me if I'm telling you something you know. 2004, I had the opportunity to go on a trip to Germany. It was an extremely complicated trip, and I almost didn't go. Family of survivors and non-survivors. But already at that time, the German Jewish community was the fastest growing Jewish community in the world, which is still true today. Russian Jews have been incentivized to go there, financially incentivized, and it's fascinating and challenging and complicated. So we're on this trip, we're going to go strengthen the nascent Jewish community, growing Jewish community in Berlin and Munich and elsewhere. So we go see other things. One of the places we went to was Worms. Worms is a very important location. Rav Yair Bachrach, the author of the Chavot Ya'ir in the 1600s, was the chief rabbi of Worms, known in Hebrew as Vermaisa, and surrounding Jewish communities. It's also a famous Jewish community because Rashi studied in a yeshiva in Worms as a young man. We now think for about 8 years. Rashi was born in France. He was born in Troyes. He then travels to Worms, studies for 8 years, and then he comes back. We still are pretty sure this, the building is not standing, but we're pretty sure that we know the building, which now stands where Rashi used to. Rashi learned, and there's this like chair where they claim that it's not Rashi's chair.
They did.
Right, like that. But it is pretty amazing to go to a place that we actually do think that Rashi, the same building where Rashi once upon a time learned, that was pretty cool. Then we went to that. Then I knew about going in. The other thing we did when we were in Worms is we went to the ancient Jewish cemetery in Worms, in Vermeiza. And it's a very old Jewish cemetery. And the shocking part of it is that as a German Jewish cemetery, it's still standing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. That's very, very striking. And I think the reason it's probably still standing is because around World War II, there was basically no Jewish community in Worms. So there was no reason to vandalize the cemetery. They weren't thinking about it. So it seems to have escaped, you know, at least complete destruction. So I didn't realize this. When you go to the cemetery, you see gravestones from great rabbis from as many as 700, 800 years ago. It's truly, I mean, it's almost an ancient, I mean, it's pretty much as ancient as you get, certainly in modern Germany. It's unbelievable. This is a community that, of course, was destroyed during the First Crusade in 1096. The Crusaders are coming through. They're marching on Yerushalayim. They don't get there to kill the Muslim infidels and recapture the city until 1999, but they're bored along the way, so they say, hey, there are a bunch of Jewish infidels along the Rhine rivers, the Kilo, what we call Kilo Chum, Speyer, right, Worms or Vermeiza, and Magenza, right, and Mainz. These are three German Jewish communities. You can Google map it nowadays. Go on Google Maps when we're done. You can actually go and look at Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, and you can find them now. You see them along the Rhine River. They're still there. Same thing, you can get a sense of the path of the Crusaders. And so the Worms Jewish community was an ancient Jewish community. And I saw the following three gravestones in that cemetery back in 2004. One was the gravestone of the Maharil. Come to Maharil in a second, before him, was the gravestone of the Maharam, Rav Meir of Rothenburg, the Maharami Rutenberg. Maharami Rutenberg died in prison in the year 1290. He was taken in captivity by the Gentiles. He was held out for ransom, refused in 1283 to allow his children or the Jewish community to ransom him. He dies in prison in 1290. He's finally redeemed some 14 years later, we believe in 1304, buried in this cemetery, and then 700 years later, exactly 700 years later, I find myself standing at the gravestone of the Maharami Rutenberg. It was an incredibly powerful experience. It was mind-boggling. And I had no idea that he was buried there until we went. It's unbelievable. And then you see the Maharil. The Maharil is the great codifier of German Jewish Minhagim. Okay, so if you want to know where Yekis get all their, you know, like, you know, emphasis on keeping Minhag, okay? To put it very diplomatically, okay?
Well,
I did. I call my father-in-law to see all the time. Not because he is, but because, you know, he's just a Yekki. Warburg is an old banking family in Germany. That's right. And so we had that conversation all the time. And so the Maharil is the great codifier of Ashkenaz of Jewish Minhagen. And for example, he says you can't change the tune if you're a Chazan. So how dare you change the tune? It's a traditional tune in our community, you know, these kinds of things. The Maharil is also very there. And the third great rabbi that I saw is the Chavob Yair, is the Yair Bachrach. So I feel a personal connection, having not even realized it, stumbled upon his gravestone back about 13 bar mitzvah hence, right, bar mitzvah ago. Rav Yair Bachrach is one of the famously quoted positions on our issue as well, and his view is exactly what Stu just said, which is that it's to snuff out the potential for life. It's as he says, so in a very colorful kind of way, for those who haven't seen it yet, he says in Siman Laman Aleph in his responsa, number 31, he says, V'fligu b'Isra, in context of abortion, he says, V'fligu b'Isra otzad shech v'zera levatala, v'atam ishum sheroi liot notzar mikol tipa zera kodesh. The sages were extremely condemnatory concerning the prohibition of improper ejaculation. And this is very unexpected in a way. He's talking about masturbation here. He says, which is, he's assuming is a biblical prohibition. And he says the prohibition against abortion is drawn from the same category. Right, exactly. The reason for that is because from every drop there is the potential for the creation of holy progeny. He says if it's usher to discard semen unnecessarily, and that's an isser min haTorah, so then certainly it's usher min haTorah to snuff out any potential for life, including abortion, which is fascinating. So he too holds that it's a biblical prohibition, but it's not full-fledged murder. It's akin to hotzaat shechvat zera levatala. And we're going to see, God willing, next time he has a very interesting response to him about exactly this issue. Essentially, that's the last opinion. So to summarize what we saw this week, and then next week we're going to look at some proof texts and practical applications. Basically, we can do it in a quick little chart, right? Basically, you have a whole host of opinions. The question is, the core question is, for a Jew, what is the basis of the prohibition? For a Gentile, it's like murder. Is a Jew also murder? So you basically have, I'll do it in Hebrew, it's an Isser Deoraita, which means it's a biblical prohibition, that's one extreme, or you have that it's an Isser Midrabanan, okay, which means that it's a rabbinic prohibition. Okay? And this is the position which is adopted by, possibly, we said before, the Tosafists, right? We said that Tosaf Nida, that maybe was saying that it's only a rabbinic prohibition, or it's a biblical prohibition, which we'll see next time is probably going to be the view of the Rambam and many, many others. But even if it's an Isser Doraita, there are three major camps that falls under. Is it a form of murder, right? Or Ritzicha, right? Or murder. Okay. To whom, right? Who do we... We saw that that's Rav Meir Simcha, right? That's Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. Okay, that's one view. You have a second view, which is an intermediary view, and you could organize these differently. But let's say this is that it's Chavala. Okay, that is Chavala or... Right, or wounding. But even then, that's split into two, right? Which is that what? You're wounding either...
The fetus or the bomb.
Right, or the mother. And this is the view of the Mabit, right? That was of Moshe Trani, okay? From Italy, that we mentioned quickly. Right, that's the town of Moshe Abtron, this is the town of Italy, the last name back in the day. Or it's a form of, right, wasting seed, which is also a biblical prohibition according to the majority view. And that's the view of, right, the Chavot Yair, or Rav Yair Bachrach, okay? So those are the basic views that we're going to see. Now, this is a very, very broad range of opinions. I mean, you basically have the, you know, like I said, you have, like, the two extremes in theory, but within that, you know, within, like, you know, the 10-yard lines, you've got 80 yards that are, right, oh, that are taken up by the rabbinic tradition. By the way, we're going to suggest next time that this is the view of the Rambam as well, so it's a very serious matter. And what we're going to see next time, God willing, is that this range of different opinions has direct ramifications for the practical questions. Well, how lenient are we willing to be? Well, if I think it's only Nisr Midrabanan, then I'd be much more willing to be lenient, right, in the case of abortion. Maybe for horrific emotional distress for the mother, we'd be more receptive. What if it's a Tisas child? That's right. What if it's a case of rape, God forbid, and this girl has to live with these, you know, young women has to live with the implications of something that was, you know, something horrific that was done to her. All this leads more room for, you know, for flexibility, and the more that you move it over to this way, the more stringency we're going to find.
So according to Tosafot, it's an Isser D'Rabbanan. What is the basis of the Isser?
That's a great question. He doesn't necessarily have to give a basis. He'd just say it's immoral, it's unethical, it's hard to say. You could say, you could kind of like, if you wanted, you could kind of like plot each of these within this. You could buy it. You could say it's like a rabbinic extension of the category of murder. It's a rabbinic form of wounding. It's a rabbinic form of wasting seed. You could see any of those, and it might make some difference. But A, they don't say, and B, it doesn't matter all that much, because in the end of the day, the key point is that it's only rabbinic, and that allows for more lenience.
And for the Ritzicha, you can also layer on it, is it Ritzicha at every... I mean, I think there it also, even if you take
at
that
both... At what stage?
At what stage?
So the other thing for next time...
Because that could actually give you leniency even if you consider it to be rich shake-up.
100%. That's a great point. We're going to absolutely come back to that next time when we look at it. As I mentioned earlier, and absolutely that next time, also the different stages. This is the most stringent possible... This is like, we're talking about like full term.
Right.
All of this. But maybe even, despite saying correctly, even, but then maybe what you're going to see within 40 days, for sure, that maybe it's considered non-viable in halacha, or maybe 3 months is, gives you greater leniency or things like that. So for sure, this is the most strict possibility, but then earlier stages might allow for more leniency. We'll see that too. So that sets us up, and then I think now we're well positioned to see how everything plays itself out. And we'll see everyone next week. Next week's regular week, as far as we're concerned. We're good to go. Fantastic. So we'll continue that. Looking forward.